This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am so happy to welcome today Steve Anderson to talk about his latest book, Lines of Deception. It's a fantastic book, and there's a lot of story behind this book. Hi, Steve, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me today.
Okay, well, Steve, I so enjoy your books, and this one is particularly fun for me. It reminds me of a lot of things in my life. I did have I've always had a great interest in the Cold War period, and particularly when you think about it today, so many of the problems we have today can be traced back to then.
Absolutely. It's a seminal period for all sorts of things, and that we could spend a whole hour talking about those.
Well, you know, with this war in Europe again, which I didn't envision it. I spent so much time in Germany, and I enjoyed getting back into Vienna with this book. So I don't know. I didn't think this would happen. Did you?
No, absolutely not. When I research these type of things, they always seem to me far back in the past and the things that could never happen again. And I think that's why they were sort of exotic to me. And it is a bit shocking to see it all coming back around. I mean, land war in Europe, that's a frightening prospect for sure.
Well, you know, this book, of course, starts off in West Germany in 1949, and we'll talk, you can explain about the Kasper brothers, because I remember the first one, which I read, was The Losing Role, and that was the Kasper brothers, that was set in 1944, in the midst of the Battle of the Bulge. I particularly remember that because my father was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yes. And I have walked the Arden Forest many times. I actually tried to trace his footsteps as far as he could remember them. So I was there through that battle, and so when I read the losing role, the losing role is, I think, that explains so much about the Kasper brothers, but I'll let you explain who the Kasper brothers are, and I think the entire premise is intriguing, so let's talk about the Kasper brothers.
Yeah, sure. First, I wanted to ask you, did your father happened to encounter any of those infamous Germans in American uniforms speaking English?
Yes, he did. Not many people know where their father was, so many years ago, but I actually know his footsteps as that horrible period started, the Battle of the Bulge, and so many people don't remember, and the recent anniversary, people didn't even talk about it on the news, but it was a horrible, horrible event, and my father's, I know where he was on Christmas Eve, 1944, because his feet were frozen, and wow. And prior to that, before the battle started, before he actually saw Marlene Dietrich, there were only two great things that happened to him during that you know, the war, he saw her, and he got to talk to Omar Bradley. And those were the only two things he'd ever talk about. And other than the fact that his feet hurt all of his life, he didn't want to talk about it. But I did when he got older, and he told me, so that's when I started walking through the Arden Forest.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. Those are some of the same footsteps in the first book of the series. I would love to talk to you more about that. That's interesting, but I should probably talk about my books. The first book, The Losing Role, takes place in the Battle of the Bulge, and the character Max Casper features in Lines of Deception. So in the first book, he is this entertainer. He just wants to love life and entertain, and he's unfortunately drafted into this desperate mission that was a real-life thing where the SS recruited but also forced some Germans who spoke English to operate behind the U.S. lines during the Battle of the Bulge. And they weren't really well prepared for it. Most of them didn't speak very good English. A lot of them were captured pretty much immediately. A lot of them just died. And some of them just disappeared. And that's the story of Max in The Losing Role, and he goes through some horrible things. Meanwhile, his brother Harry is growing up in America because the family had emigrated to America, and Max had stayed behind in Germany. So in the second book, Liberated, Harry is sort of this naive American occupation officer who arrives in Germany and thinks he's going to change the world. But what he finds out is very quickly that it's a lot more complicated than that, and he basically has to expose a plundering racket that's being run by his fellow American officers. And so they've been separated by war, these two brothers. They're different in many ways, but in the third book, Lost Kin, which is set in 1946 Munich, the brothers are finally reunited, and Harry helps sort of rehabilitate Max in that they join together in this effort to free Cossack refugees that are hiding from the Soviets, because if they get sent to the Soviets, then they will probably be sent to gulags or executed. So they both join together to do some good, and now they're forced to reunite again, and this time it's Max who is going to attempt to save Harry. He ventures in many spots behind the Iron Curtain to find out where Harry is and what he's doing, and hopefully redeem himself as well.
And, of course, this one is called Lines of Deception. And
yep,
boy, there's nobody better at writing about deception than you. You really capture, well, first of all, of course, your books are very atmospheric, and I know it sounds funny, but I find it so much nicer to go back in time. Those days seem somehow better. It's crazy. I'm not sure I can handle the current situation, but you make the stories during the Cold War come alive, and this whole post World War II period where there were so many different forces pulling it in so many different directions, and all those strings have unraveled and raveled. And so this book, I thought, was, it's just very, there's a lot of also cleverness in it, I think.
Oh, thank you. That's kind of you to say. I'm a sucker for period movies and stories. So, The Third Man, of course, set in the Vienna that we both love, and Eric Ambler espionage stories, if you know those. In my work, I tend to become obsessed with things that are between the lines. So there's always these underdogs who are caught between cultures, or caught between the front lines. In this case, literally, we have the Iron Curtain. And in the case of the espionage writer Eric Ambler, everyone's not a super spy or a specialist. They're amateurs, kind of in over their head, and they make it up as they go along. And that's, if there's any theme in all my work, it's that. And I think it really fits for the Cold War period because there's a lot of gray areas.
Well, exactly. And it is the sort of everyday person that makes the story so interesting, because people are all messed up in this world. And when just you get that feeling with your stories, that really, like, there's a word I don't want to use it online, but it's just the people. You say, what? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? What are you doing? And so when you're, particularly, I'm thinking about Vienna, and my own trips to Vienna when I was studying and working there and doing research. I had the same feeling, though. There were many times, and this was, you know, many years later, of course, not, you know, not after the war, but there's still that element of, I think people are, there's still a lot of things going on in Vienna. So I had that same feeling that you've captured in your books.
Yeah, I mean, Vienna's perfect because it's sort of, you know, caught in the middle of everything, caught in the middle of history. It used to be an empire. It was, you know, separated in those four allied sectors until the mid-50s. So it's right at kind of the edge of Eastern Europe. So what a great city.
Oh, it is. I don't know if you, well, I used to love the Hilton Hotel, the spiral stairs in the Hilton Hotel.
I did not check that out. I should have. There's so many nooks and crannies and lobbies and everything to check out.
Well, one of the I had so much fun. I loved walking down those stairs because when you'd walk down, of course, I was very young and I was wearing high heels. And when you walked down those stairs, it was dramatic. And I'll never forget the time I was reading, I was learning a lot of things, and I was carrying, this is funny, I was carrying a Russian newspaper one day when I came down the stairs. And I walked to the lobby, and I was going to sit down and write some letters to my sister and tell her, you know, I'm at the Hilton Hotel in Vienna and on the stationery. And I hadn't been there for more than 5 minutes when this very suspicious looking guy comes over and just looks at, like, you know, are you a spy? So it was lots of fun. But you get that atmosphere in Vienna even today, because there are so many different country people from different countries hanging around the lobbies of hotels. So you capture that, though, and I like, you know, this idea of the brothers, one raised in America and one raised in Germany, and then bringing them together, this whole series, it's a difficult subject, but I find it a fun read.
Oh, thank you. I try to get in some period, you know, language and slang and things, and I try not to overdo it, but I hope that kind of lightens things a little bit sometimes, and there's a little bit of humor too, because the brothers like to goad each other. They're sort of different, you know. Max is more casual and wants to live a good life. Like I said, oddly, I kind of think of him sort of as an Austrian. Like he likes to, you know, he's sort of cosmopolitan. And he loves music and that kind of thing, and doesn't want to do anything that is too sad or, you know, too grueling. Whereas Harry, he thinks of himself as an American, but he's ironically kind of that stereotypical Prussian German who's very focused and headstrong. And even though he wouldn't admit it, so they kind of go at each other that way.
Well, you have a lot of interesting characters, as I said, you know, because it is so international. You have Americans, you have Israelis, you have, you know, a wide range of characters. Tell us a little about Katerina.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, because I have to always mention Katerina. She's sort of the through line in Harry's story. She's like a lot of female characters in my books. This is probably true in real life as well. She's always a little bit smarter than them. She knows the right thing to do immediately. And she's a former star of stage and screen unfortunately in Nazi Germany. And so that all ended. Might be like what someone like Marlene Dietrich herself or others would have ended up if they would have stayed. And so she's now at this point in the story with Lines of Deception, she's trying to make up for what her country did during the war. And she's working for the Israelis as an assassin. I can't go too far much away.
But, don't give it away.
She's found that her skills as an actress and on the stage kind of transfer over real nicely to this sort of espionage, which is, by the way, something that Max has unfortunately found out, and he's kind of accepted it as part of his fate that, you know, if the CIA wants him to do a thing or two once in a while, he's indebted to them and to Harry, and so he'll use those skills when needed. But yeah, Katerina is I love the character. I would love to just do a Katerina book, but we'll see.
Well, I think it would work because she is fascinating, and you made her so, when a character really sometimes takes over part of a book, you feel it, and you definitely get that feeling with Katerina in this book. And the other books too. So, what was your writing? I didn't mention that, of course, you were a Fulbright fellow, and that's how you. I think that's how you got to Germany, right? As doing research at the time.
Yeah, it goes back a little bit. The first time I was there, I was in. Have you ever been to Tübingen, Germany? Beautiful, medieval university town. I was there for a language, everyone should visit, it's beautiful. I was there for a language program, that's where I really got interested in German. As a real naive undergrad, grew up in a suburb of Portland where I live now, and that was my first experience. I went back in 1990 because history was happening, and I was in my backpacker phase at that time, just out of college. I can talk, if there's time, I can talk about that because it relates to...
Yeah, do. I love that phase of life I went through. Talk about it.
This is part of my research, I think. I met some people smarter than me who told me, don't try to go to get a career right away or go to grad school or what have you. Go and live life. And I was a history undergrad, and I looked around at the world, and the Berlin Wall had just come down, and so I saved my money and resolved to go to Europe and travel as long as I could, and with the intention of going to Eastern Europe for as much as I could. And so I did that, and it was fantastic. I ventured into East Berlin, Prague, Krakow, Poland, and also the Auschwitz camps. Budapest, Slovenia, the Croatian coast. And it's weird to look back because I wanted to see history before it went away and all that. And it was truly another world. I mean, most of it could have been 1955. There was no Western advertising. I must have looked like an alien to some people. It's amazing now how off the grid I was. I could have disappeared and no one would have known the wiser. But I think that experience, oddly, somewhere in the back of my head, informed the routes that Max takes in pursuit of Harry in this book. Because in Lines of Deception, Max travels to the East Soviet Vienna. He goes to Soviet Prague, East Germany, Communist Poland. So that was definitely kind of a parallel there that I almost got to retrace my steps in a way, if that makes sense.
No, it does. I love it because I was, when I was young, I did something similar. And even now, when I think about it, when you look back at going to Poland during the, you know, just after the Russians left, you know, were finally pushed out. It was a strange place. It was just for an American. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very intimidating, even though, you know, when I was in East Berlin, it was the spring of 1990, and it was kind of a foregone conclusion that East Germany was going to eventually get reunited, but they still looked very badass, for lack of a better term. All the border guards and, you know, all the controls and things like that. And I remember them, ironically, as being much nicer than the West German border guards. But it was a fascinating time. You know, going back to what you were saying about, it's hard to imagine the things they are like now. Back then, everyone thought the world was going to be vastly different, and it turns out that human nature kind of makes things not as great as everyone hoped, I think.
Well, I guess we don't learn from history, because
yeah,
it blows my mind to think of it when you see the destruction, when you see the buildings, and you see, you know, the first time I visited East Germany and also Poland, you know, there were still buildings that had been damaged, you know, during World War II, and then they were just getting out of it. You know, they were just rebuilding and doing everything, and now this comes along. So, but I think what will happen with this book, I think Lines of Deception is so well written and it's so intriguing that it will, in a way, sort of people will say, wow, you know, this is a good read. I needed to know some of this stuff. It puts a little bit into perspective that area of the world, which is so vital and so important to everything that's happening in this world. And to understand, when you talk about deception, I guess that's the key, isn't it?
I think so, without giving it anything away. It does definitely plays into the story a few times over. And that's very kind of you to say about the book. I appreciate it. I put everything into these and try not to let the research kind of overcome the story. I try to let the research serve the story. So I hope I'm doing that.
It does. It creates the atmosphere. Now, so you hadn't originally planned to be a novelist, and that just sort of happened? How did that happen? You wrote
your
first book.
Question.
It took a little time before the first book was done?
So I did this Fulbright research fellowship in 93, 94 for a year, and I was researching my master's. Thought I was going to get a PhD in history. No thoughts of writing fiction. But a few years later, I revisited my MA thesis, which was on plundering and corruption in the very early U.S. occupation of Germany. And again, this is that between the lines thing. I had read so many things in reports about, you know, such and such did this and such happened, but it never really clarified what actually happened. And I thought, oh, this between the lines stuff is great for fiction. I could make stuff up instead of having to report things with big gaps in it. That led to my very first manuscript, which I can now say to the world was a pile of crap, as they usually are. But ironically, that first manuscript, I kept reworking it over the years, and in a much different form ended up as Liberated, the second book in this series. and I did not understand at that point that the main character of that book was Max's brother. It was only as I started building these stories that I had this light bulb moment where I realized, oh, these two guys are brothers. They're German Americans.
Oh, it's so exciting when this happens, when you start writing, and then why I named this program Joy on Paper is you do find this joy on paper that you see your words and you know that what you want to say, and then you keep working them over, and people sometimes will say, well, you know, I don't know if I can do that, you know, but that is a great, it's such a learning experience to rewrite and to just keep working it until one day it just sort of clicks on you, as this did with you, that, wow, I've got two brothers here. Boy, oh boy, I can do something with them.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I never would have found that out unless I rewrote over, you know, years, putting them down, working on something else, trying. It's with fiction, you know, you really do have to learn as you go along. And it's a cliche, but it's the good stuff's all in the rewriting. That's where it comes out. You know, as you might know, once your fingers start knowing what the character is going to do next without you having to think about it, that's a really wonderful state to be in.
Oh, it is. When they take over, when the character takes over your life, it's fantastic. It is more than making a new friend. It's making somebody who doesn't leave you alone sometimes.
Yeah, that is very true. But I actually wanted to add another thing about the research, just because I'm so indebted to my parents. I was lucky enough to have much older parents, and I was the youngest of four, and they were from the World War II era, and they had this basement full of all this memorabilia they kept, Collier's magazines and stuff that you don't know about today. And that, I think, originally sparked my interest that came through later in the research.
And the research is so much fun. That is one of the best things about becoming a writer is the research. Now, of course, the problem always comes to getting an agent. well, more so, of course, in the time when you started, because your first book was published, what year was that? I don't remember.
The Losing Role, I put out myself in 2010 originally, in the early days of, you know, the Kindle and all that. But I, meanwhile, had finally, after many starts and stops, landed my current agent, who I can't say enough about. You know him. He's a brilliant and intrepid Peter Riva, who's been on your show also. And
yes.
Peter's been great. He understands what I do and the stories I'm trying to tell. And so he eventually found a way to get these books out, and then the series re-released with my new publisher, Open Road, and who's now putting out Lines of Deception. So, I can't say enough about Peter.
Well, I think Peter is worth his weight in gold, because he is so good, and when he must have, when he started reading these, been reminded, as I was, of course, of his grandmother, Marlene Dietrich, because she was an important part of my life, all of my life, from the time I was a child, from the time my father would talk always about that meeting, about the day he saw her. And she was, you know, she was very brave, such a brave woman. No other performer. And that's why I think the Losing Role was so interesting, because we have an actor there. And of course, she was such a great actress, but she went right to the front. She went right out there to sing to the American soldiers and to just give them that moment. Sometimes when you think about it, and because, as I said, my I come from Northern Michigan, my father was a lumberman. And so for him, walking through the forest in the middle of the winter, he was looking at the trees he was studying the trees, and he was thinking about how when he got back to northern Michigan, he would make sure he wanted. He was really already thinking about the importance of you know trees as something that we have to preserve, that we have to keep. And he remembered that day when she was driving, you know, she was in the back of a Jeep, and she was in the front seat, and then she stood up and took off her helmet, and her beautiful hair came, you know. He remembered that all of his life. He would talk about it. So this, the Battle of the Bulge, I think, is also something that when people read the Losing Role, they might think about it and maybe appreciate more what our soldiers and what our American soldiers did, and what somebody great like Marlene Dietrich did during the war. So there's just so many wonderful things about your books. I love them all. I think they really, there's something that people, if you can start with this one, and then, you know, Lines of Deception, they stand alone, so you can start with one and then go back and sort of dig out the rest of the story. But I've done a beautiful job, Steve, with this, and I'm very happy that you know, we had a chance to talk. And I'm hoping you know, I always see stories, if I really love a story, I see it as a film in my head. And I saw from The Losing Role. Now, I had read that long before I, you know, years before, because I have 200 books about Napoleon and another 200 books about the Battle of the Bulge. I have everything ever written about Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, who my father loved. So I read that book when it came out. So, I mean, I'm sure I always would buy, you know, the books when they came out. So, and it stuck with me. And then we had this wonderful connection here of Peter Riva and sending you to me and me to you. But I'm hoping that this is a kind of story that you have now enough books in the series that somebody has to pick it up and do a streaming series on you, on the Casper Brothers. I can see that. I would love it.
Oh, that would be fantastic. And I do hope someone's listening. It's interesting what you say about the trees, because I think that's maybe subconsciously part of my work too, because there's a lot of trees. And it's partially because, like northern Michigan, I live in Oregon, and I'm in the green part of Oregon and surrounded by forests, even in the city. So I know what you mean there. And it does hopefully create some wonderful visuals. So
it does. It does. Well, I have to let you go now. But Steve, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. It's Steve Anderson, Lines of Deception. And, of course, you have a website. And
there's many Steve Andersons.
I was going to say that.
It's my full name. It's Stephen with a PH, F as in Frederick, Anderson. So StephenFAnderson.com. Okay. And there's a newsletter on there that if people want to get updates about my work. I just learned that there's an audiobook of Lines of Deception coming too. So that's pretty exciting. But Lines of Deception has been released just today. I don't know if I mentioned that.
Yeah, today's a release date. That's what I love to do. That's why I started this program on a Tuesday, and I didn't know at that time that that's when most books were released. So it worked out fine. So today is a release date, and so I'm so happy that you were on Joy on Paper today. Lines of Deception by Steve Anderson. It's a great book. Everybody get it. And I think you'll enjoy it, because I predict that this is going to be a streaming series one day on one of the streaming services. Okay, Steve?
That's so kind of you. Sounds good. It's a great pleasure to be on your show. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye. Take care.
Okay. All right. Listen, Big Ed in the control room. As always, you know, sometimes I get Oh, I don't like to look at clocks. We just had this clock thing going backwards or forwards or whatever. I don't know. I don't care about time anymore. But do we have Rebecca Sugar on? Because let's go straight to Rebecca, and we'll talk about my wonderful sponsors later on. So let's talk to Rebecca Sugar. Hi, Rebecca. Are you there?
Yes. I am.
Okay,
hi.
Rebecca. Sorry, I was running a little bit late because I was talking to Steve Anderson about his book and having fond memories of being in Vienna. Now let's talk about your book, Rebecca Sugar. I love that name. It's so good. It's such a great name. And the name of your book is Everything is a Little Broken. And, well, you know, I have, of course, I've read your column, which, you know, is fascinating. And we'll talk a little bit about that and talk about this book. During the pandemic that I would be getting a lot of books written during the pandemic. And everybody sort of selected whatever I think was the thing that they needed to do. I've had some who are really scary books. I've had some horror mm-hmm. books. I've had some zombie books. I didn't realize that so many people would turn to zombies. As some romance, and then of course a lot of heartfelt books, and so Everything is a Little Broken. This is your first novel?
It is, yeah.
Okay, so there you are in the pandemic, going through a lot, and you've decided to write a novel. So do you want to sort of lay the groundwork of what the book is about and how you came about with the idea?
Yeah, sure, of course. Thank you for having me. I didn't actually decide to write a novel. I'm a columnist, as you said. My column, The Cocktail Party Contrarian, is in the New York Sun, and I'm used to writing, 500-word articles about various topics. And COVID was a time, of course, when there was a lot of time, and I was sitting around, and I'm used to writing. So I just sort of started writing organically without really thinking about what I was writing. And when I looked up, I had about 30 pages, and I didn't really think of it as a book. And about 6 months later, I sat down, and the rest of it just sort of poured out of me. And a series of strange events happened. I didn't even have a book agent. I just sort of bumped into someone who had a publisher and who recommended me, and he decided to publish the book. So it was really a lot of sort of involuntary events that led me to write this book, but it was it's a fiction novel, but it is very much based on personal experience, as I think a lot of fiction is. It's the story of a woman who is watching her father start to age and decline in physical health, and what that does to her, to her relationship with him, to her relationship with all the people around her, and it's a struggle with faith and with reality and the cruelty of old age sometimes. But it's also humorous and told with some tongue-in-cheek response to a really hard subject and a hard time in life for people.
Well, in a way, by taking sometimes the very personal and turning it into a novel makes it easier to write about.
It does. And it also, I found, at least for me, when you write a fiction novel based on reality, you get to go back and change the actual reality into what you maybe wished it had looked like, right? So that was helpful.
So, well, tell us about the character. And, of course, we'll assume so a lot of it was based on you, but also, as you said, you've made changes. And so just tell us about the character and how she came to you and how you developed that.
Well, Mira Kane is a 47-year-old woman. I made myself a little younger in real life than I am. I'm 53.
Isn't that nice?
yes, that was lovely. I could have even gotten younger now that I think about it. And she is, the novel opens with her visiting her father in the hospital after his second spinal cord surgery. And my father is 83 now, and he has been through two spinal cord surgeries. And it's Mira visiting with him and sort of recognizing that he has a long road of recovery ahead of him, and knowing that she's going to have to deal with that in some way with him. And he's a very physically weak, but mentally, emotionally, and spiritually strong person, and a proud man, and a man of incredible dignity in a very undignified moment in his life. So she and he sort of deal with what's happening to him with banter and humor, which is really how my father and I deal with what happens to him. It's sort of medicinal, both for the person going through the recovery and the person who loves them and who's trying to help them. And throughout the course of this experience, Mira discovers a lot about herself, about being in that place in life that I think a lot of us find ourselves in, and a lot of my friends certainly at this moment find themselves in, where you're sort of confronting the future and what's going to happen when your parents aren't here anymore and you are the next sort of adult layer in the room and you have children, and what will that mean for your relationship with them? And at the same time, there's an older woman in the story who was a real woman in my life. In the book, her name is May, and she was the nanny of Matt Frank, the father, when he was growing up, and also the nanny of Mira when she was growing up. So she was in this family for 70 years. That character is also a real character, who was Ella May in my life. She was my father's nanny growing up, and mine, had been in our family for 70 years. A devout Pentecostal Christian woman, a deep abiding faith. And Mira finds in the story, Mira is a Jewish woman in Manhattan, and she finds herself and her lapsed faith sort of not helping her to navigate this incredibly important moment in her life. And she clings to May's Christian faith because it's so abiding and so unbreakable. And she's so attracted to that and wants to resurrect her own, but can't. And so she goes through a journey with May, who... This is not a spoiler alert, because in the novel she's in her early 90s, so she does die at the end, unfortunately. And Mira has to learn how to take the lessons she's learned from May and her sense of faith and kind of find ways to build on that in her own self as she deals with her faith and her father. But again, I hope that I'm not making it sound like a deeply sad story, although it is sad in its own way, but there's a lot of humor and joy in it, which I think is true of life. It's a mixture of both.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, I have, may call it an eclectic selection of authors come on the program, because I never know what book will touch a person's heart. Sometimes, right. It can be a book like this about, you know, illness. I've had, you know, people writing books about addictions and painful things that have happened to them, abuse, or in this case about dealing with the, you know, people who are aging and have needs and requirements that. Sometimes you don't think that this is going to happen to you, but when it does, to have a book that is gives some sort of some background and some understanding, and I think as yours does, some encouragement and hope. I think that's why I have, you know, I could do every day, I could do a program 5 days a week and talk to New York Times bestselling authors about, you know, some, you know, just fiction that's you know, popular. But I like to do this to give an author like you an opportunity. It's not only just your first novel, but it's also a novel that is very, you know, people might say, well, you know, it's too difficult a subject, but on the other hand, there are people who say, yeah, you know, I need this. I want to know. I want to understand. And it touches their hearts. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. You know, I think I read that there are 41 million Americans who are caring for an older parent or someone in their family. There are a lot of people who experience this. Now, my story about Mira and Matt is one story. It's a story of a New York story. It's a story of a man who is in physical decline. There are so many variations on the theme, people with cognitive decline, people live all over the country, people who have resources, people who don't, people who have family that support them, people who don't. I can't really speak to every, you know, situation, but I think there are certain themes that resonate for everyone, right? In the story, there's a sibling, Mira has a sibling who is sort of distanced from the family. Nobody really understands why, and he's not really there. He's not really there to help. If I sat and thought about all my friends who have, you know, cried to me over lunch about caring for an elderly parent and whose sister or brother or many sisters and brothers, you know, just weren't really as supportive as they could have been or should have been. Or, you know, there are a million different ways that this plays out for different people. But I tried to touch on different themes. And, yeah, it's sad. I think life has sad moments in it. We all know that. To get to a certain age, you certainly know it. But I think that was important to me, this sort of humor piece, not humor, laugh out loud, belly laugh humor. There are things that happen to Matt in the story that are not funny at all, actually. But even in those moments, he and his daughter kind of find a way to look at it and sort of, with a nod to the absurdity of the human condition, kind of laugh at it all. You know, we're all sort of ridiculous. We're all fragile. We're all frail. I'm 53, and sometimes I get out of a chair. I always say, and my lower back hurts, and I let out a little grunt, and I think, how ridiculous, right? We all are. The most powerful and strong among us are all just human, and at some stage, if you're lucky enough to live into old age, things happen to your body, to your mind. I think just being sad about it, at least for me and my father, it doesn't serve us well. So we like to confront it, recognize how sad it is, but then also try to find moments of humor and joy in spite of it.
Well, I think you've captured that. You have, you know, with your art, your column, The Cocktail Party Contrarian, there you have this humor that I think you've put some of this into this book. And your writing, you're a spectacular writer. Of course, your work has appeared in every place. I think Wall Street Journal, Washington Examiner. I think, I've read it, you in the Jewish News, quite a few different magazines. So you're a fine writer. And this Thank is you. The start of the, this is the first novel. But I'm sure, as I said, you already know the joy of writing. Now that you know the joy of being a novelist, I'm sure you're going to be working on another novel. Am I correct?
Well, everyone asked me that. And the truth is, this novel took me by such surprise that it's not like I had specific plans to write the next one. But it's not like I don't have some thoughts and ideas. And we'll see. I hope so.
I have a feeling. This is just... The writing is too fine to be.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just fine. Super. You know, I always say when I get a book and I say it's solid, it means I don't have to worry about anything. I know the writing is good, and you are a fine writer. And I have a feeling in about a year you're going to be back on Joy on Paper, and you're going to have a new book and a new novel. to tell me about, okay?
I predict. All right. I mean, if you say it, then I'll abide by it.
Okay. I say it. I insist upon it. I need you back. All right. So Rebecca Sugar. I love to talk to somebody named Rebecca Sugar. What a name. Perfect.
Yes, so, I married well.
You did. What a sweetheart, right?
Well, okay. Sweetheart. We'll talk about that next time.
Okay, well, maybe that'll be the next book. And this new one, the first one, is called Everything is a Little Broken, and it's available online. Do you have a website?
RebeccaSugarOnline.com.
Okay, and people, get her the New York Sun. I think it's every Friday or every other Friday you have your column in there, and they're great columns.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye now, Rebecca. Lovely talking to you. Bye-bye. Okay. So, as I said, you never know when you need a book. And this one, it's a subject that's a little bit difficult, but on the other hand, when you put a difficult subject in the hands of a great writer, wow, you can come out with something really amazing. So I hope that you will, particularly if you have anybody that you're caring for, or you know somebody who's going to be caring for, or somebody's going to be caring for you one day, you might want to get this book, Everything is a Little Bit Broken, because it gives you insights into things that you should know about and care about. So let me just take a minute to I didn't run the commercials, but I want to particularly thank Glenn for all of his support. And then Bill Larson, our intellectual expert, our legal eagle, he is going to be on the 21st on Joy on Paper. And I hope that if you have any questions about intellectual property, and oh my goodness, I have lots of questions about AI. It's really messing people's heads up. But I think Bill might have some information that you will want. And if you have any questions, send them in to me, patsy.radio@joyonpaper, and I will tell Bill, and Bill will answer your questions. But meanwhile, he always wants to remind people, be careful what you write in your social media, because you don't want it to come back and haunt you. So just be careful about that. And what else? Oh, lots and lots of things. I have this wonderful, wonderful interview coming up. Oh, I can't break the news yet. It's something really, really fantastic. But I have to just confirm it. So I've got all of this happening. And special thanks again to Bria Burton. She was so wonderful as my guest host in February, and she's going to be a guest host again here at the end of March. So I'm looking forward to that. And also, I'm hoping that Devon Miller will also be a guest host. He's in school right now. My goodness, he's going to graduate in May, and he does our book buzzes for children. And he's also going to be a guest host and interview some children's authors. So there's a lot of things happening. And it's really exciting. I want to thank everyone for their messages at celebrating the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper coming up on Thursday. Everybody, thank you so, so much for your kind messages. I really appreciate them. Meanwhile, make sure that you say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. It doesn't matter where I am. What I'm doing, I'm always saluting Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything that you do for me. I really appreciate it. I cannot believe it is 9 years ago. Almost 9 years. It's crazy. Anyway, everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye now.